Isfahan and Shiraz are what attracts most visitors from far and wide, but I'm sure many nature-loving individuals have become interested in visiting Iran's southernmost region and the pristine natural wonders of Sistan and Balochistan. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, required features of dining table. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the required features of dining table, which is necessary to look after while we eat or drink something on the dining table. In the Islamic lifestyle, when we talk about the Islamic lifestyle, obviously it pays attention to all the aspects of the life, especially when someone sits on a dining table and he wants to eat or drink something. What we have here is basically there are four required or necessary features that should be looked after while a person is sitting on the dining table. The first one of them is to know or have the knowledge of what you're eating, where it has come from. The second thing is the happiness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Is it in there or not? The third thing is to take the name of God before you eat. And the fourth thing is to thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, when we talk about these four features, which is necessary that a person, when he sits on a dining table, before he starts eating, he should pay attention to all these four things, that he must know where this has come from. The knowledge of the food itself, it is very necessary that we should know where this food has come from, and what is the ingredients of this food which is in front of me. And if we can pay attention to such thing, then obviously we will be eating something which is recommended by Islam or which is recommended by God, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the required features or the necessary features of the dining table. And we said that the very first feature is that you should know what you're eating. So we should know that who is the provider of the food, where does this food has come from, and whether this food that we are eating, what kind of ingredients that it has. Generally, we know that obviously, especially those who are living in the West and nowadays in the East as well, because the things are being imported and exported. So there are many things, For example, if someone wants to eat a kind of jelly or chocolate, you know, the sweets. So you should look at the ingredients first and see whether the things that are in there, the ingredients, there should be the halal ingredients. And that's why we can see that there are many products on which in today's world, like they write halal on top of that to convey the message that all the ingredients are halal. So basically in Islam, it is important to look at the ingredients of the things that we are eating, to pay attention to what you are eating. It is allowable. It is makruh. For example, it is said not. It is better to not to eat something. If such things are in the food, then we need to avoid. If it is haram, it is forbidden, we need to avoid such food. Especially when you go to a restaurant, you should know about the restaurant, that this restaurant, do the people who are working in that restaurant, are they Muslim? Can we eat the food by their hands? Are they cooking or making the halal food or no? They're also serving haram food as well. Can I buy, for example, a burger from McDonald's? No, you cannot, because the oil in which they fry the things, they fry the chicken and all those. Obviously, they put the other ingredients as well, non-halal ingredients as well. So there are many things that we need to pay attention to, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
Saudi Arabia has executed 81 men over the past 24 hours, including 7 Yemenis and 1 Syrian national, on charges including terrorism and holding deviant beliefs. State news agency SBA said on Saturday, 12th of March. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Reuters news agency. The piece is titled, Saudi Arabia Executes 81 Men in 24 Hours. Saudi Arabia has executed 81 men over the past 24 hours, including 7 Yemenis and 1 Syrian national, on charges including terrorism and holding deviant beliefs, state news agency SBA said on Saturday, 12th of March. The number dwarfed the 67 executions reported in the Saudi kingdom in all of 2021, and the 27 executions in 2020. These individuals were convicted of various crimes, including murdering innocent men, women and children, the state news agency SBA said, citing a statement from the Saudi Interior Ministry. Crimes committed by these individuals also include pledging allegiance to foreign terrorist organizations such as ISIS, Al-Qaeda and the Houthis, the statement added. Some travelled to conflict zones to join terrorist organisations, the state news agency SBA said. The men included 37 Saudi nationals who were found guilty in a single case for attempting to assassinate security officers and targeting police stations and convoys, the report added. Saudi Arabia's human rights record has been under an increasing scrutiny from human rights groups all over the world and Western allies since the murder of distant Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. Saudi Arabia has faced strong criticism of its restrictive laws on political and religious expression and the implementation of the death penalty, including for defendants arrested when they were minors. Saudi Arabia denies accusations of human rights abuses and has tried to justify the executions by saying its national security was threatened. Meanwhile, a new report from Saudi Arabia has suggested that at least three members of a Saudi hit squad convicted by the kingdom of murdering Jamal Khashoggi are living and working in seven-star accommodation inside a government-run security compound in Riyadh. The new report originates from a source connected to senior members of Saudi intelligence. The assassins are believed to be staying in villas and buildings run by Saudi Arabia's state security agency, far from the walls of its infamous prisons. The source has spoken to two witnesses who claim to have seen the men. They said family members frequently visit the men, who are able to use a gymnasium and workspaces on the site. All were sentenced before a Saudi court in a trial broadly condemned as a sham, though only one of them, Salah al-Tobagi, was named. Some received death sentences which were later commuted to life terms. The sightings cast further doubt on Riyadh's claims to be holding the murderers of Jamal Khashoggi to account, and come as Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's most trusted advisor, Saud al-Qahtani, has re-emerged in the royal court after 3 years in hiding. Saud al-Qahtani was acquitted of any involvement despite a Western intelligence assessment that he has masterminded the assassination of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi at Prince Mohammed bin Salman's behest. The source confirmed that Salah al-Tobagi, the forensic scientist who dismembered Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul, was one of those seen inside the facility. Mustafa al-Madani, the body double dispatched by the hit squad team to create the ruse that Jamal Khashoggi had left the consulate building alive, has also been seen, as has Mansour Abu Hussein, who is accused of leading the operation. Both witnesses have visited the compound on several occasions in the past 2 years. They say the men were relaxed and appeared to be performing normal duties. Visitors, including caterers, gardeners, technicians, and family members, frequently attend the compound, according to the intelligence source. The sightings of Salah al-Tobagi, Mansour Abu Hussein, and Mustafa al-Madani took place in late 2019 and towards the middle of 2020. The witnesses would not publicly disclose their names for fear of retribution from Prince Mohammed bin Salman and by state security, which wields a heavy hand in Saudi Arabia. Mansour Abu Hussein and Mustafa al-Madani are known to be intelligence officers employed by the Saudi state security. Their boss, Abdul Aziz bin Mohammed al-Huwairini, has been seen with some of the accused and is often spotted using the compound gymnasium. In December of 2019, after proceedings shrouded in secrecy, a Saudi court acquitted three defendants, sentenced five more to death and a further five to prison terms. The five men sentenced to death were not organisers and were eventually legally pardoned in May of 2020 by Jamal Khashoggi's children in an arrangement brokered by Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince. Little has been revealed until now about the whereabouts of the main players in the murder plot, but their apparent presence in a modern, well-equipped intelligence compound in Riyadh, where they enjoy freedom of movement, is starkly at odds with assurances by the Saudi royal family that the perpetrators of the murder face tough punishment.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the pitch. on Youth Station.
I am a Muslim, Islamite. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is Youth Station.
Yes.
And I have with me Asma. I'm Zainab. Asma, assalamu alaikum.
Yes, and this is Asma. You're hearing us from IRIB English Radio, and we're very happy to be here with you once more.
Yeah.
It's a privilege.
Same here, and it's a privilege to be with you, Asma, always.
It's always so nice to be here with you.
Same here. How are you?
Just fine, thank you. Well, what are we going to discuss today?
Again, I guess expectations. Yeah.
Yes, again, the following session of expectations.
So, Asma, we did expectations of parents.
Just to recap the previous session.
Obviously, I wanted you to do that.
The previous episode, we talked about the expectations of parents from their children. We said that they have some expectations which are fair enough. They expect you to be kind, to return all the goodness they've done to you, and also to help them at the age when they are unable to do things, to stand on their foot. You have to be their foot.
And they expect you to keep your phones aside.
Yes.
Not to be indulged in your social media apps.
Now, the story...
To give them some time. Mm-hmm. To spend with them.
Now, since Youth Station is very fair to the youth, we are going to look at the other side of the story. What children expect from their parents.
Wow. Discuss about the parents'
expectations. I think what children expect is way more than what parents would expect.
True. So what do you say, Asma? Let you start this time.
Actually, just to start it, just to open up the story, I would say children would expect their parent to treat them well.
To treat them well.
Yes. That's human right.
Well, I think they'll expect them to be... Not compare them with the neighbors.
Yes, not compare them with other children.
Exactly, with your neighbors, with your relatives.
Accept them as they are.
Accept them the way they are. I mean...
And after all, they are whatever you have nurtured them to be.
Yeah, like if you're expecting average student to get average grades, average student should get average grades. Mm-hmm. But once your student is getting average grades... You think his intellectual level is always average. No. I think here parents are making a mistake. They should think, where was the fault? Why my child got average grades? Was he not interested? Did he not understand the chapter? Actually,
maybe he was sick.
Maybe she was not interested in that topic. Maybe she was suffering from some mental issue.
Exactly. Maybe she's going in a
maybe
phase
she was
that
depressed.
She's not telling you.
Yeah. Maybe she was depressed. So... Besides looking at these problems, I think my student got average grades, and since his, therefore, the result is that, which concludes, my student is average, intellectual. He's not intellectual enough. Mm-hmm. While most of the times the story is other side. What do you think, what are the other expectations as well?
Well, I would say some parents push their children, their kids... So unconsciously it happens. They push their kids into the wrong direction by forcing them to choose a specific major. For example, marry a wrong person.
Yeah.
Or just, I don't know, things like this. They happen a lot. We see of these examples. a lot around us. And specifically about girls, sometimes they force them to marry the wrong person. And then that poor girl has to suffer her entire life.
Entire life. Mm-hmm. I know things. I have known things.
Yes, we see a lot. You know, we hear stories a lot.
We hear stories. We know stories. We see girls suffering.
And also provide them a respectful life.
It is true that parents have good experiences. And on the basis of the experiences, they try to tell you the decisions. Mm-hmm. They try to tell you that, I think this is the right choice. This is the right thing, this is the right thing to do. But here I think the parents where they fail is to see the interest of the children.
Exactly.
To see the interest. I mean, I luckily got married to a very good person, but when my parents did, I hope they're not listening. Well, was that once the family of the guy came to our home, without just like, they got so excited with them, like, okay, the guy is studying Hausas, he's Islamic and all, alhamdulillah. So from my end to our end, it's 90%, okay, now we have to ask girl as well. And I was looking at them so angrily.
90% is okay, how come?
Okay. How can I say 10%? Okay, how, like my portion is 10%.
Yeah.
Your portion should be 10%. I should be the 90%
decision
maker. But luckily, alhamdulillah, a guy came up to be a very nice person. But I was lucky enough.
So
I
think you were lucky, told but there are people parents. Who are not lucky.
Even if you're 100% excited, if you 100% want to give your daughter to them, just tell them, we'll think about it.
Exactly.
Don't give your percentage. The
give
moment you're
space.
Giving your percentage, you are kind of, you know, your daughter is getting involved. She's getting under pressure. Oh my God, if I say no, the other family will think that
and
girl
she,
had some affair
she
somewhere.
Might, she might most probably think that her...
Parents
her point
don't care
of view
about her.
Is not important.
Not important at all.
Everything
and
is
then,
done.
And then, you know, the interesting thing my parents were talking over here mm-hmm. was that since the decision of our daughter is extremely important, so we need to even ask her because this is her life. This is, and I was wondering, how do you call 90%?
How about the 90%?
Yeah.
What happened with the 90%?
But that was out of excitement.
Yes.
I know my parents well. They have been very good friends. The best part of my father was that I was in class 9. I was 14 years old or 15 years old, and my father came to me. He told me, forget that I'm your father. I'm your best friend. So whatever you like, whatever you want, whatever you cannot share, please
yes.
share it with me. I'm your friend. So he broke that gap, you know, of
yes.
parent-child relationship. But yes, there are expectations that now a kid will come and share everything
well,
with me.
Well, then let's go to another part, which
yeah.
is providing children or the kids with enough of facilities for education. You know that even now in this modern society,
yeah.
in this modern age, there are some kids who are undereducated.
Yeah.
And this is very sad in an age where people have to have some degrees in order to follow their life or interest. There are some people... that when they grow, they do not have anything to say in society.
You got me across so many stories. I don't know what to start with.
Yes, I told
you.
It's
like, you
a
know,
lot
have,
of people are suffering from this issue.
Children, we are discussing what children expect from their parents.
Yes.
They
yes,
expect,
just for the people who joined
expect,
us, we are talking about the youth expectations from their parents.
Youth, what children expect from their parents, especially the youth. So I remember a lot of stories mm-hmm. around us. I remember a lot of stories of our relatives. I remember a lot of other stories which were like, you know, especially these neighbors' kids. Oh, hell with them.
You know, about boys, that maybe the family is having some monetary problems. Then the boy has to go to work has to go for a job at an age where he's very little and young. You know,
child
at
labor.
An age of 10, he's going to work.
He's going
and
for
he's
child
going
labor,
to
yeah.
be the money maker.
Yeah.
And then for girls, they have to stop studying and stop their education while they are so clever.
I'm getting your point. I'm getting your point. We had this thing in our area, in our
yes,
region.
Yes, yes.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
We had the problem that to clarify your 10th class or 12th mm-hmm. class, especially when you had medical studies, you could not go on without a teacher. You could not go on without a private tuition.
Mm-hmm.
And this private tuition was so expensive.
Yes.
That had become a business those days. And that was so, so expensive. So the people who
and
went
And then
for,
that poor person who doesn't, who cannot afford,
yeah, yeah.
then has to stop studying.
Even if they are intelligent enough.
Intelligent enough. And they
because
could
they,
accomplish
they get this
so
depression.
Much.
Now I don't have money and I cannot go for a private tuition.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, my parents are expecting a hell lot of things out of me.
Yes.
That's the worst part of the story.
And
you know, that's
society.
The worst part of the story that your parents know. You do not went to private tuition. And
mm-hmm.
my neighbor's child went to private tuition. And once your neighbor's child comes up with a doctor, a lawyer, or I don't know, some officer, and you're telling your kid, see how he became a good doctor.
Okay, you have to pay for it.
Yeah.
It's expensive. That's
no, no,
why
no.
he's
I
not
mean, I have seen this. The kids, they expect their parents to tell you, I'm sorry I could not spend for you.
Yes.
Had I spent for you, you had been the doctor.
You could have been better.
You could have been doctor or
yes.
you could have been better than that
yes,
person
exactly.
and this person. But reverse is happening in the societies today.
Mm-hmm.
Reverse I have seen happening. The families tell their kids that, see, that person who is not worth of your intellect, he became a doctor and you're nothing.
This is very wrong.
You're nothing.
This is very
This is the
wrong.
Worst expectation of parents from
mm-hmm.
the kids.
Yes.
And especially your parents are interested in some particular field. Maybe they are interested in law, but
exactly.
you're interested in medicine.
So as
they
we
want you
said,
to do law.
Providing educational facilities is very important.
Yeah.
That's in parents' hand to do that
your
for their
job
children.
Job as a parent is to provide facilities, not to decide their stream.
Yes, exactly.
Not to decide the stream. Let them decide.
And if we want to go, the list is growing.
Growing
we could add
yeah,
to
yeah.
this list
on
more
and
more,
on.
But this is all the time we had just to go for a gist of
yeah.
it.
And I think we must not miss
mm-hmm.
out. The important part that students expect from the parents is understanding them.
Exactly. This is very important, having the same language to understand each
other. To give them space as
Islam
well.
Islam says that parents should pick a good name for their children.
Yeah.
They have to.
Yeah.
They have to provide them with facilities.
And they'll be asked tomorrow.
Yes,
they'll
and tomorrow they'll
be
asked.
Their blessings. A son
mm-hmm.
is called a blessing
yes.
and a daughter is called
yes.
The rahmat, the mercy. On parents, so they'll be asked about these
So
things.
Thank you, Zainab.
Thank
it was
you
such an awesome time being here with you.
Yeah,
we
I don't want to end with you whenever I'm sitting with you. I
yes.
want to discuss for the whole day.
We could go like this until night, but
yeah.
time is flying. Thank you for listening. You were listening to Youth Station. This was IRIB English Radio.
Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullah.
Wa barakatuh.
I am what I am. Because you made, I have what I have. My love is strong. Because of you, in weakness I am braver. My defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love. Strong because you are the one.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the war between Russia and Ukraine drags on, there are indications that Ukraine has hosted U.S.-funded labs to develop biological weapons. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland has admitted that Ukraine hosts biological research facilities.
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian troops, Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces.
So that Victoria Nuland, the guru of the Maidan, who was passing out cookies to the fascist Azov battalion in 2014 during the coup against the legitimate government, was forced to admit that these facilities were there. She didn't clarify what they were exactly, but she indicated that they were dismantled quickly in order to prevent them from falling into the hands of the Russians.
The admission came after Russia published documents showing that Kiev was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon. The dangerous pathogens across Ukrainian biolab facilities included anthrax, the plague, tularemia, cholera, and other deadly diseases. In the past several days, long-standing fears, which we have expressed repeatedly for years, regarding the development of military biological materials by the United States on the territory of Ukraine under the auspices of the relevant U.S. Special Services, have been confirmed. Earlier, the Russian Defense Ministry said it had found evidence of U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine, which had urgently destroyed samples of deadly pathogens when the military offensive started.
I think the United States was caught by surprise now. At first, they've been denying all the accusations that are being made, you know, over the past few months that they're conducting biological warfare research, you've had this incident here, which initially they really couldn't deny.
Russia says U.S. statements about Ukraine's biolabs indicate fears by Washington that the pathogens stored there may fall into the hands of Russian experts. Moscow says they confirmed the U.S.'s violation of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention.
So either through surrogate or directly, the United States seems to have been involved in creating a capability that would give a country, an allied country, or the United States, a possibility to conduct biological warfare, and that, of course, is forbidden by a variety of UN conventions.
Russia says it had been closely monitoring the bioweapons programs that were developed by the Pentagon in post-Soviet countries. Russia has accused the U.S. of working in Ukraine since 2005 and being involved in the construction, modernization, and operation of over a dozen biolabs suitable for storing or working with pathogens, including those used in bioweapons.
The fact that they existed in Ukraine, where there was a almost obsessive concern and hatred, I must say, among some of the leading factions, right-wing factions in the Ukrainian government against Russia, that they, I think, would be quite prepared to use them in a war with someone they consider their deadly foe. And if they did so, it was with the full backing of the United States, who set up these facilities in the first place.
Moscow has expressed deep concerns about these facilities in recent years. Moscow says facilities in Ukraine were developing components for biological weapons, noting that in the near future, the ministry would release its analysis of the received documents. Russia also accuses the U.S. of sponsoring biological labs across a number of former Soviet republics, including Kazakhstan, Armenia, Tajikistan, and Georgia.
The aerospace force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps successfully put a reconnaissance satellite into orbit. The Noor-2 was launched from Imam Khomeini Spaceport in Semnan Province. The satellite reached a low orbit of 500 kilometers above the Earth on an Iranian three-stage Cossett carrier, which used a combination of liquid and solid fuels. The Noor-2 became Iran's second military satellite successfully placed in low Earth orbit. Commander of the Space Command of the IRGC's Aerospace Force said Iran's national space and defense organizations, knowledge-based companies, and universities cooperated in the Noor-2 project. Brigadier General Ali Jafarabadi explained that the domestically manufactured satellite incorporates the newest technology. It is the upgraded version of Noor-1, which was launched into orbit 21 months ago. Data obtained by Iran's second military satellite can have multiple general and defensive uses. The Noor-2 will orbit the Earth every 90 minutes and will pass over the Iranian sky 16 times every day. Its mission will last at least 3 years. The commander explained that the IRGC will launch a series of Noor satellites in the coming years to consolidate its position in low Earth orbit before aiming for the orbit 36,000 kilometers above land. The latest achievements of Iran's space program came a few days after the IRGC unveiled two underground bases housing state-of-the-art missiles and attack drones. Iran has been relentlessly developing new weapons and military equipment, arguing that it needs the means to defend itself in the world's most volatile region. Just weeks ago, the country unveiled a state-of-the-art ballistic missile with pinpoint precision. Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for the world's most advanced missile shields. Iranians have stressed that their defense program grew out of the war initiated by Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they have no choice but to build their own defense industry. The latest achievements strongly suggest that Iran's pursuit of robust defense capabilities is in full swing despite stringent American sanctions.
I think that these developments send several interrelated messages, the first and foremost being that Iran's technological development will not be held back by the obviously failed efforts of the United States and its allies to curtail Iranian technological development. It sends another similar message regarding sanctions, that sanctions are going to be completely ineffectual in terms of holding back Iran's scientific as well as industrial development.
Iran is still engaged in the negotiations in the Austrian capital aimed at removing the sanctions, but its defense industries are not waiting for the talks to end in an agreement. Observers believe Iran's launch of a military satellite into orbit as talks in Vienna are still underway is sending a clear message that it will never negotiate over its defense capabilities and that no agreement can ever restrict its defense, missile, and space programs. The Islamic Republic has made it clear that it will never ask for permission from anyone to manufacture its own means of defense.
The world is closely watching the Russia-Ukraine conflict as it can potentially end in outcomes that would send shockwaves across the globe. Russia launched what it calls a special military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. That came despite weeks of warnings from Western capitals that such a move would bring catastrophic results. The United States and its allies decided not to confront Russia directly and resorted to supporting Ukraine with intelligence and military hardware. They launch another war that isn't fought with bullets or rockets, but affects banks and financial institutions, an economic war. Washington and its allies have announced several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mostly targeting its banks and energy sector. The scrapping of the highly anticipated Nord Stream 2 pipeline project that would transfer Russian gas directly to Germany was among the measures. Moscow has already warned that it could cut its gas supplies to Germany via the Nord Stream 1 pipeline.
The implications of this event on the economy, the implications of this for the Russian economy, I don't think are quite as tragic as some of the Western press would like to have us believe, because I believe that the Russians have a great many more shock absorbers because they are less exposed than many of the Western capitalist economies.
The tensions risk escalating into a wider energy crisis in Europe, which has over the past year experienced shortages of fuel and price hikes. The military conflict and ensuing sanctions are already showing their effects, but not only on Russia. Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak said crude prices could surge to over $300 per barrel if the US and European Union ban imports of oil from Russia. Oil prices have already spiked to close to $140 per barrel, the highest since the 2008 financial crisis. Western sanctions on Moscow, coupled with logistics turmoil, have also shaken markets for other commodities. U.S. wheat futures rose more than 7%, nearing an all-time high amid fears of supply chaos. European wheat has already hit record highs as deepening Western sanctions against Russia fueled concerns about exports from the Black Sea region. Russia is the world's biggest wheat exporter. Russia and Ukraine account for about 29% of global wheat exports. In stock markets, European shares fell to their lowest in a year, with Germany and Italy's benchmark index slipping into a so-called bear market.
The economic impacts of this crisis, of this war, is not something that we're going to be able to that the world will not be able to undo, even if there is a peace treaty in the short term, because the disruptions and the lack of confidence in the old geopolitical arrangements is a permanent damage that will profoundly affect the world economy.
What should be taken into account is that you can't simply remove a cog from the system and expect it to continue working without a hitch. Sanctions might hurt Russia for the short term, but in the long run, everyone will lose.
A U.S. delegation of senior State Department and White House officials traveled to the Venezuelan capital, Caracas, to meet with President Nicolas Maduro's government. The meeting is the highest-level visit by U.S. officials to Venezuela in years. It also coincides with an ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The question is, why should such a meeting take place at this time? Venezuela and the U.S. severed all diplomatic relations in 2019 following Washington's recognition of pro-U.S. opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim president over the legitimate president Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. then imposed sanctions on individuals with ties to Maduro's government and on companies involved in exporting Venezuelan oil to provoke regime change in the Latin American country. Venezuela soon felt the impact of sanctions as its oil production reduced significantly. In response, Caracas turned to Russia, as well as Iran and China, for diplomatic and economic aid. Russian energy companies and banks have since played a major role in Venezuela's exporting of oil. Fast forward to today, Russia is involved in a conflict with Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he will only halt his country's military operation if Ukraine is stopped fighting and if Moscow's demands are met. On the other hand, Western governments have targeted Russia with a barrage of sanctions. The U.S. has imposed a ban on the exports of specific technologies to its oil refinery sector. Washington has also blacklisted over a dozen of Russian entities with ties to the country's military and defense sectors. Meanwhile, European Union has excluded seven Russian banks from the global SWIFT payment system. The bloc has also banned two major news networks, namely Russia Today and Sputnik. And Germany has decided to freeze the Nord Stream 2 project. In a bid to punish Russia for attacking Ukraine, the US and its allies targeted Moscow's oil and gas sector via sanctions. And countries like Venezuela are potential substitutes. In addition, while the war in Ukraine continues unabated, Washington is paying closer attention to Moscow's allies in Latin America. Current and former U.S. officials believe that's because Washington thinks they could become security threats if the standoff with Russia deepens.
The U.S. is going to try to divide Russia from Latin America and the Caribbean. And interestingly enough, according to the White House itself, a lot of the sanctions imposed on Russia over this whole Ukraine nonsense are designed to target Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua because those countries are also sanctioned by the U.S. And those countries are also dependent on Russia for aid. Russian support and aid is one of the main reasons why these countries have been able to overcome the sanctions to begin with. So in a sense, the U.S. is targeting these countries indirectly by hitting Russia, and I think people are not going to fall for it.
In a public speech on Thursday, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro stated that his country is open to discussing oil deals with investors from all around the world, including the U.S. In case Washington restricts the imports of Russian oil, Venezuela would be able to replace some of the lost supplies. The U.S. sees Latin America as an opportunity to advance its agenda among Latin American countries allied with Russia. But the U.S. is not that popular in Latin America for many reasons. In slightly less than 100 years, from 1898 to 1994, the U.S. intervened successfully to change governments in Latin America at least 41 times, or once every 28 months for an entire century.
The U.S. has launched a number of military coups to try to overthrow the left-wing government in Venezuela. It has used all diplomatic and sanction means to try to do so. None of this has worked because the Venezuelan government has the backing of the people and also internationally has the support of countries like Russia, Iran, China, Nicaragua, Cuba, and many others that stand in solidarity with the Venezuelan government.
The United States has long interfered in the internal affairs of Nicaragua, a Latin American country it once occupied from 1912 to 1933 as part of the Banana Wars. Washington has imposed sanctions against Nicaragua's government and president Daniel Ortega's inner circle since 2018 when protests erupted in the country. Meanwhile, Cuba suffers from chronic shortages of electricity and food exacerbated by brutal U.S. sanctions. It also holds Washington responsible for stirring up violence in the country and blames its economic woes mainly on U.S. embargoes. And there is a long list of other countries in the region that have been victims of the U.S. sanctions and its intervention in their domestic affairs. While Washington seeks to find a substitute oil producer to fill in the place of Russia to further pressure Moscow by imposing stricter sanctions on its oil and gas, U.S.'s dark history continues to haunt it. Will Putin's Latin American allies stay loyal to him, or will they forget all hardship the U.S. has inflicted on their people for years?
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
Today, training researchers and scientists is a long-term need. The issue of procreation and reproduction, which I have been emphasizing so much, is another example. Today, if we do not think about reproduction, then it will be late to solve the problem in 15, 20 years. We will become a country that does not have enough of the necessary elements to move forward. That is, the youth. Today, we have to think about tomorrow. That is the youth. Today, we have to think about tomorrow. Another example is nuclear energy, on which the whole world is becoming increasingly dependent on a daily basis. We too need peaceful nuclear energy sooner or later. Today, if we do not think about it, if we do not follow the matter, it will be late tomorrow and our hands will be empty. When the world dominates all aspects of this issue, it will be difficult for us to move forward that day. So, you see how cruelly the enemy front is focusing on the issue of our nuclear energy? They impose sanctions while they know that our nuclear energy project is peaceful. They say that Iran is such and such, an amount of time away from proceeding a nuclear bomb. These are nonsensical and meaningless remarks.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They themselves know that we are not looking for nuclear weapons, and that we are only looking for the peaceful use of nuclear energy. They understand and know this. They do not want the Iranian nation to achieve this great and significant scientific progress, and they are putting pressure on us because the nation will need it tomorrow, and they do not want this movement to continue. If we fail to address these future and long-term issues today, we will face problems tomorrow. In the case of the JCPOA in 2015-2016, my objection was that certain points had to be observed so that no further problems would arise. My objection was mainly to this. I said to the officials that they had to consider certain points, and I frequently mentioned them in my recommendations. Well, some of those points did not receive attention, and therefore the subsequent problems that everyone is aware of arose. So looking to the future and being prepared for it is important.
That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A two-day summit of European Union leaders in Versailles, France, to discuss Russia's military operation in Ukraine concluded with increasingly belligerent rhetoric possibly overshadowing the rejection of concrete sanctions. Led by the Eastern members of the bloc, the EU will not impose sanctions on Russian gas and oil. In mid-May, a proposal could be unveiled to phase out Russian fossil fuels by 2027. The Western members of the bloc led the swift rejection of Ukraine's appeal for fast-track membership to the bloc. The EU and NATO claim they have excluded direct military intervention in Ukraine. The EU did double to 1 billion euros the amount of military aid for Ukraine. It's the first such military involvement for the bloc, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012.
There have been three strategic objectives which Russia did not anticipate. First, the resurrection of NATO. Second, the awakening of Europe. And third, the unity of Ukrainians. I think the Russians had a bad strategy.
Some in Europe are saying that Russia's military action is on the same level as 9/11 and that the EU must bolster cooperation on defense and drastically boost military spending.
Europe needs its own army. After the 1980s, Europe became disarmed and completely reliant on the Americans. Ukraine is the door to Europe, and now Europe has no choice but to arm itself. Europe needs to reconceptualize its own image into one where they can defend themselves.
If the EU follows through on some of these promises and sanctions, Europe will likely see a multi-year effect on prices of food, energy, and basic goods. The green transition, which some think is so vital, will likely need to be reversed. The summit ends much as it began. It's not fully clear how far the EU will go to get involved in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. A poll last month showed that two-thirds of France is favorable to organizing a referendum on leaving the European Union. If massive and controversial changes aren't approved by a democratic vote, it's possible that the EU may be fomenting even more discord. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.